And Decatur. For more information, visit patellawteam.com or call 217-384-1111. And now stay tuned for Disability Beat.
My name is Ann Russell from the National. My name is Ann Russell from the National Alliance on Mental Illness. You are listening to Disability Beat on WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM, community radio for East Central Illinois.
This is Disability Beat, a public affairs program for and about people with disabilities. It's about social justice, community supports, inclusion, accessibility, freedom, and choice. My name is Vicki Nicewander, and I'm the host of this program and also the parent of a fantastic young woman with a disability.
The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, associate station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated.
Stay tuned for an interview with Kristen Owen, Executive Director of Choices Coordinated Care Solutions. But first, disability news for the week of December 12, 2016. The Supreme Court review of a battle between the parents of a child with autism and his Colorado school district could help raise the standards of education for some of the more than 6 million school children with disabilities across the United States, but it could also prove expensive for school districts. Federal law guarantees students with disabilities a free and appropriate public education, but precisely what that means isn't well defined. Federal judges often have had different interpretations of what they're entitled to, something lawyers for the Colorado Family and other advocates for students with disabilities say leads to better education and more services for children with disabilities in some states than others. But some groups that represent school administrators fear that setting a national standard would prompt more parents to demand additional services for their children, leading to costly court battles and forcing schools to spend more on therapies or pay for some children to attend private school. The case named for a 17-year-old student who is referred to as Andrew F. in court documents is stated to be heard by the justices in January. The legal battle largely boils down to whether children with disabilities are entitled to some educational benefit, as the 10th U.S. District Court of Appeals ruled in the Colorado case, or whether schools should meet a higher standard and provide a meaningful benefit to students, as federal appellate courts have ruled in cases from Pennsylvania and Tennessee. Stay tuned for that story. Three former employees of Sunmount Developmental Center in Tupper Lake, New York, have been sentenced for assaulting a resident in 2014. In June, a jury found the three guilty of charges that included felony counts of assault and endangering the welfare of an incompetent or physically disabled person. The three men were among four employees of the institution indicted last year in the assault on an 18-year-old with disabilities in October 2013 and a subsequent cover-up. In a second similar story, an employee at a Buckley facility for people with developmental disabilities in the state of Washington is accused of raping a woman who has the mental capacity of an 8-year-old, according to court records. County prosecutors charged 60-year-old Terry Wayne Shepherd with second-degree rape on Monday last week. Shepherd's bail was set at $500,000. Shepherd works at the Rainier School, a center run by the State Department of Social and Health Services. He was booked into jail on Sunday, and after another employee who told police Shepherd is her supervisor, she reported the alleged rape. She said she was looking for Shepherd to ask whether she could take a break and found him in a residence room having sex with the woman. About 320 adults live at the Rainier Center. In a year when the U.S. Department of Education fielded a record number of civil rights complaints, new data indicates that allegations of disability discrimination are up dramatically. Nearly 6,000 complaints of disability discrimination were submitted to the Education Department's Office for Civil Rights during fiscal year 2016, which concluded in September. That's up from 4,800 the year prior. The figures come from the annual report released Thursday, detailing a skyrocketing number of complaints received by the Office for Civil Rights, which is charged with ensuring equal access and prohibiting discrimination based on race, color, national origin, sex, disability, and age in education programs. Overall, there were 16,720 complaints in fiscal year 2016, compared to 10,400 the previous year. Disability-related complaints accounted for 36% of those received in 2016, according to the report. The vast majority of disability complaints related to the right to a free appropriate public education, or FAPE, followed by allegations of retaliation and exclusion or different treatment. Several complaints touched on more than one of 18 categories that are tracked, the agency said. Over the course of the year, the Education Department said that it successfully resolved more than 5,000 disability-related complaints. Said Catherine E. Hammond, Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights, quote, "We thank our school communities for palpable progress toward realizing the promises Congress has made decade after decade to our nation's students that their educational experiences should be fundamentally equal. Our investigations confirm ongoing need to safeguard those rights, as well as daily commitment from educators across the country to our core democratic value of fairness," end quote. And finally, legislation that would provide tracking devices and resources to help kids with autism and other developmental disabilities at risk of wandering is one step closer to becoming federal law. The U.S. House of Representatives voted 346 to 66 last week to pass the measure known as Kevin and Avante's Law. The bill would expand an existing program that helps people with Alzheimer's disease who are prone to bolting to include children with developmental disabilities too. Approval came 1 week after the legislation was nearly derailed. Privacy concerns from conservatives led the House Judiciary Committee to postpone a planned markup with little time remaining before the end of the current Congress. In light of the concerns, language was added to the bill indicating that tracking devices would be non-invasive and non-permanent, and that, quote, "the procedure to install the technology or device does not create an external or internal marker or implant a device or other trackable item," end quote. Research shows that about half of kids on the spectrum have wandered away from a safe place, and advocates point to more than 100 deaths stemming from wandering incidents since 2011 involving students with autism or Down syndrome. The legislation would provide the U.S. Department of Justice with $2 million annually to issue grants to law enforcement agencies across the country for tracking devices, training, and other resources to address wandering. Families could request wearable tracking devices from participating law enforcement agencies, which would not be actively monitored, but could be used to locate a child who is reported missing, advocates said. The legislation would not require parents or guardians to use such technology if they do not wish to. The bill's chief sponsor, U.S. Representative Chris Smith of New Jersey, said on the House floor, quote, "This will save lives. Wandering is a serious problem. We want to get our loved ones, find our loved ones who have developmental disabilities or have Alzheimer's, and make sure that they get back to a safe and secure environment as quickly as possible," end quote. Even with House passage, however, the bill is not a done deal. The U.S. Senate already approved a version of the legislation by unanimous consent in July, but the measure now heads back to that chamber for reconsideration due to differences in the House bill. And that's the news for this week.
Looking for a clever line for your protection. Looks like I'm looking, but I'm not trying to find one new direction. Believe me when I say that I try. Don't believe me when I say that I never lie. I'll never lie.
You are listening to WEFT Champaign, 90.1 FM. This is Vicki Nicewander. I'm joined in the studio today by Kristen Owen, who is the Executive Director of Choices Coordinated Care Solutions, not to be confused with Community Choices. Choices Coordinated Care Solutions is a relatively new provider in the community, and so I'm thrilled to death to have Kristen here today to talk about what they offer and what they do and how they differ from other providers in the area. So welcome to the program, Kristen.
Thank you for having me, Vicki.
So let's talk first about, let's have you introduce yourself and how you got connected to the area of service coordination for kids with needs.
Okay. It's a fairly long journey for me. I began my professional career as a therapeutic recreation specialist working in a residential facility for youth in the care of the state. Mm-hmm. And I did that for some time out of college. And that was my first exposure to youth in care. I think youth with significant mental and behavioral health issues in that setting. And when I left there, I went to a consulting firm who worked primarily with the Department of Children and Family Services. And the first project I worked on was looking at the department's residential population. They had a high number of youth in care in residential facilities at that time, and their goal was to move youth to home settings, community settings. So that was back in 1997 when I first did that, and the state had an effort around moving youth, and I was involved in that for about 5 years, and the state made significant decreases in their residential population, and they also saw a high number of youth go to adoptive homes. And Illinois was recognized nationally at that time, so I was involved in some of that and those conversations with the department. I also worked with monitoring the residential population to make sure that they were on track to leave those higher end settings, and there was a plan for step down, as it's called, and moving youth to less restrictive environments, primarily, again, community settings, relative homes, foster homes, or back with birth parents. So that came a little bit after that. And then I worked with DCFS's HealthWorks of Cook County. I was a provider relations director there.
And for those who don't know what DCFS is,
Department of Children and Family Services. So they are the public guardian for youth that are removed from their homes due to abuse and neglect. So that was the population I first worked with. And HealthWorks of Cook County, well, we have HealthWorks across the state of Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
And HealthWorks across the Department of Children and Family Services works to ensure that the youth in care get the health care services that they need and that health issues are identified, particularly early on in custody, so they can be addressed appropriately. And so my primary role there was to work with primary care providers that were seeing youth in care, mm-hmm. youth in the care of DCFS. And in the midst of all that, I got my master's of public administration at Roosevelt University. And so with that degree, I was able to then become the director of the CARES line, which is Crisis and Referral Entry Services. This was all with the same company. They had several different contracts with the state. So I sort of, I had the opportunity to do many different things there and increase my skill set and my ability. And I am very thankful for that. And at the CARES line, that was the youth mental health crisis hotline for the state of Illinois. So it's a single point of entry for youth that are experiencing a mental health crisis. And the CARES line is charged with doing a brief assessment to determine if a youth is in crisis, and then to refer the local agency. There are 45 agencies that the CARES line works with throughout the state that then respond face-to-face for a crisis assessment within 90 minutes of receiving that phone call.
Wow.
Yes.
That's a lot of stuff. So
it is a lot of
choices
stuff.
Is not necessarily connected to that. That's separate
no.
from what you're currently doing. So talk about what you now do.
That exposed me to choices. And so in 2014, I came to the area. I had not been here. I'd been here in school here, so I was familiar with the area, but choices brought me back to this area to do coordinated care. So Choices is a demonstration project that began in January of 2014, and we began serving youth that are in the care of the Department of Children and Family Services. So we started with that particular population, and we work with youth that are in congregate care currently, so they're in residential settings or group homes, or they're in specialized foster care or traditional foster care, and they may be experiencing a placement disruption or potential placement disruption. So there's risk that they'll move up in level of care. And so our care coordinators step in to help to coordinate that team of people. And so we work from a systems of care perspective. And some of the primary values you see in systems of care are family-driven and youth-guided, community-based, and culturally competent are three significant values that we work under. And we work to establish a child and family team, whether a youth is in the care of the Department of Children and Family Services or a youth is receiving Medicaid. That's the second population we began working with in November of 2014.
Mm.
And so we have care coordinators that work with both DCFS and HFS youth. HFS is the Medicaid youth.
Thank you.
And you're welcome. And we work to pull all those people that are significant to that child and that family, whether they be professional supports or natural supports. So we would ask therapists, teachers, coaches to be part of that child and family team, as well as relatives, ministers within the family's congregation,
mm-hmm.
Neighbors, if they're significant supports to the family, to come together and to assist in developing a plan of care. So while we might have multiple systems involved with our youth, whether there's a plan at school, there's a plan for permanency and custody within the Department of Children and Family Services, or there's a plan for health care for a youth that may be Medicaid enrolled, or there's a treatment plan within a community mental health center, we work to make one comprehensive plan. And that's because it can be really confusing navigating all those systems, and it can be difficult for a family to manage all those different pieces and keep them pulled together in a coordinated way. So our care coordinator is charged with that primarily, and pulling those people together for a single conversation, a single plan, and putting the family in the forefront to say, these are the goals that we want to achieve as a family. Or if it's a youth-guided plan, because the youth is older and transition-aged, we would say what that youth desires to achieve.
Mm-hmm.
And it is the team's responsibility to come together and have that coordinated conversation and talk together to help the family achieve their goals and recognize where there may be barriers or challenges. And the plan and the team works collaboratively to address those things and make suggestions, and we work on a consensus basis. So the team's got to agree before things move forward.
Now, I would think that if you have kids who are in residential services that are wards of the state and, you know, are in that kind of a situation, it might be kind of challenging to engage families who may be, have been, become disconnected.
It is
from
difficult.
Their children.
I would agree with that, Vicki. And I think one of the efforts that we try to make in talking with our youth that are in care, in the care of the state, is to say, who are the people that are significant to you? You know, is there a birth parent that you've lost contact with or that you're not connected to that we can reestablish? And so long as that is allowable, because sometimes we're not able to do that, given the circumstances and the youth's history and the parent's history, we work to reconnect. If there is a relative that that youth remembers from a few years ago that they don't have contact with anymore, we will look to see if we can establish a connection. And recently, I think it was June of 2015, the Department of Children and Family Services passed a new policy that allows children to be placed with what they call fictive kin. So they are not people that are related either by marriage or blood to that youth, but who that youth sees as their family.
Mm-hmm.
So there could be that neighbor that was significant in their life. It could be a former teacher that had a huge influence and they made a connection with. And we have seen some of our youth placed with fictive kin since the department opened that avenue for permanent placement. And I think that's been really rewarding because sometimes there aren't family members for the youth in care that we work with. So I think to find someone who is a significant role model and care, and can be a caregiver for that youth and see that connection made and that home established is extremely rewarding.
It sounds like a very complex process.
It can be, yes. I think when you work with the regulations and procedures that are involved in the Department of Children and Family Services and the Department of Health Care and Family Services. So when you look at Medicaid regulations, it can be pretty daunting and pretty intricate, and we have to stay up to speed on that.
And how many kids roughly do you serve?
Roughly about 430 right now, and that's between both our projects, DCFS and HFS.
Okay. And so, you know, of the 430 that you serve, what is your average, what you would call a success rate for, you know, kids that really, you work with them through transition, right? Until they turn 22?
We don't work with them that long necessarily. We would work with them either until a permanent home is found and there's been a successful transition to that environment. So a youth returns home to their birth parent or is adopted, for example. And for our healthcare and family services population, we look at the progress made by the youth and family. So one of our primary goals for both the youth or both populations that we work with is to create and empower families to be more self-sufficient and to be able to navigate systems and manage their own team, whatever that looks like for them when they leave choices and are no longer involved with us. But they can identify the people that are important to them and important to their success. And so we also work on identifying like no-cost, low-cost resources within the communities that we serve. And so families know what those avenues are and where they can go for assistance, whether it's food assistance, utility assistance, clothing assistance, things of that nature. So we really work to make families self-sufficient. And we would measure success for our youth in care in a permanent home. And we would measure success for our youth in healthcare and family services as reduction in, say, those crisis calls that I mentioned that I'd been formerly involved with, less disruption in the home, more stable and peaceful home environment, because those our youth in healthcare and family services aren't removed from their home. They may be placed in a psychiatric hospital, on occasion, and so we would want to see a reduction in those instances and the family better able to work through those moments of escalation mm-hmm. that will come up. So that's how we would measure that.
Yeah, and it seems to me that that would be a very high stress kind mm-hmm. of a situation. Oftentimes you're talking about children, youth with, you know, extreme mental health issues mm-hmm. on occasion. So is there a degree of, do you help connect the family members to counseling or some kind of training, something like that, that would help them deal better with their children?
Yes. So we work with the entire family. We have the particular youth enrolled with us. But when you look at the child and family team and the plan of care, it doesn't just address what the youth is dealing with, because kids don't live in a vacuum.
Right.
We need to have the entire family on board to create change in the environment, change in the approach to that youth. And or it could be a change in how the parent approaches the school about mm-hmm. issues with their youth. There are several different levels that we work at. And so we do provide services to parents directly. We may have parent training, and so they can better manage youth behaviors at home. We might see parent peer support, which is a unique service that we have. It is an individual that has lived experience, and by that we mean they have their own child with significant behavioral mental health issues, and they have been trained to provide support peer-to-peer or parent-to-parent on how you manage situations and provide guidance and support and help to empower that parent to move forward and to achieve that success. So there are several things we can do to support parents.
Do all of your referrals come from DCFS and from Health and Family Services, or is it, can people walk in and say, we need your help?
No, unfortunately, they have to come directly from the Department of Children and Family Services or from Healthcare and Family Services. So they would identify youth that are either having placement issues within mm-hmm. DCFS or placed in those higher levels of care, or for HFS, they're youth that have been screened in a crisis situation.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the primary indicators that a youth is having some issues and a family needs some additional support, or they might see high utilization of behavioral support services as paid by Medicaid. So those are a couple indicators they use.
Do you have students only who are from this area of the state, or are they referred to you from anywhere in the state of Illinois?
The youth that we serve are from Champaign, Ford, Vermilion, or Iroquois County. We serve a four-county area.
So relatively local.
Mm-hmm. Yes, relatively local. And so for our Healthcare and Family Services, they have to reside in one of those counties to be enrolled with us. And for our youth that are involved with the Department of Children and Family Services, our four counties are identified as the home county or the county of placement, so where we would like to see them come back to. Their case may have originated here, and now they're coming back. And so they may be placed in residential facilities throughout the state of Illinois. We have several youth that are up north. We have a few down south in southern Illinois. So we are working to bring them back. Or there may be a relative here that's been identified as someone who will be a permanent placement. And so we work to bring them back here.
So for people who are out there listening, how can they help you be more successful? Is there any role that the community has in the work that you're doing?
I think there's a huge role that the community has. And one significant thing that we do is we've established what we call the Family Leadership Council. And those are primarily parents involved with choices who work to, one, give choices feedback about how we work
mm-hmm.
And our procedures, our policies, and how our success in working with youth and families. Do we have high customer satisfaction? So we look at our family leadership for that. But I would also say that it's a place for other parents to come to find community and to find a place where they can find other like-minded people.
Mm-hmm.
But I think one thing I would look to the community for is reducing stigma around mental health issues. Mm-hmm. I think that's a huge piece, and we need to look at that much differently as a community, and we need to welcome our youth and our families that deal with these significant issues in a different way, and welcome them in school settings, church settings, across the community as we, you know, after school programs. I think we've seen many of our youth get kicked out of mm-hmm. things due to behavior, due to an inability to interact appropriately. And I'd like to see some more patience and some more understanding. So we do work to educate the community. We've had a couple of community opportunities for education. So we did some trainings around being trauma-informed mm-hmm. because experiencing trauma in your life can have a huge impact on behavior and development for right. youth. And so we've tried to do some of that. And we've also, we did a family-driven conference last year in May, and we're doing another one in April based on hope and humor.
Well, we'll have to have you on the show again when that starts getting close and talk about it. That would be great. So if people want more information, where do they call? You have a website?
We do have a website. It's choicesinc.org. And you can also call our benefits line, mm-hmm. and that number is 866-858-7722.
Thank you very much for joining me today. Kristen Owen, Executive Director of Choices Coordinated Care Services, right?
Solutions.
Solutions. Got it.
Vicki, thank you so
much. Thank you. This and other episodes.